It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about some common verbal phrases that we like to fall back on, like, I hate to be the one to tell you this, but... And we'll find out what we're really saying when we use them.
First, Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources is proposing adding nearly 200 waterways to a list of those that don't meet water quality standards, with excessive levels of phosphorus being the main culprit.
The list already contains more than 700 bodies of water in the state. And while the DNR says most waterways are improving over the long term, getting a body of water off of that list is easier said than done.
Joining us now is Aaron Larson, Water Resources Management Specialist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be here.
How does a waterway find itself on this list in the first place? What are some of the criteria that are being considered?
So assessing water bodies against water quality standards is part of this overarching process that we conduct as part of the Federal Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act gives us authority to adopt water quality criteria. They range from chemical parameters, things like phosphorus, for example, ammonia, other toxic pollutants. And we also measure other indicators like indicators of stream health, like biology, things like fish or invertebrates that are, that occur in the streams and lakes.
High levels of phosphorus have been a major culprit here, according to some reports. What is to account for these high levels?
The source of phosphorus varies across the state. Phosphorus is a naturally occurring element, so it can come from just from the soils naturally, but there are human induced sources as well, things like urban runoff. So when it rains, the rainwater carries with it soil that's eroded from the landscape, and that has attached to it phosphorus. And so anytime it rains, we can get runoff that's delivered to our water bodies that can elevate the concentrations of phosphorus in the water.
And what about fertilizers?
Fertilizers, yeah, those are another human source. We apply fertilizers to farmlands to increase their productivity. Excess fertilizers can also run off during those rain events and end up into our waterways.
Are there other common pollutants that you're seeing showing up in our waterways?
The most common of the standards that we've assessed, phosphorus is the predominant one. Of the total number of listings that we're proposing for new water bodies to the list, 137 of them are water bodies that exceed the phosphorus criteria. That I should mention too that part of the reason that is that we are targeting specific water bodies that we suspect to be impaired for phosphorus. So we may have some indication based on preliminary data or professional judgment of the field staff that there are problems at those water bodies. We follow up with additional monitoring to identify the extent of the pollution.
Are you seeing more concentration of that type of pollution in certain geographic areas around the state, or is it fairly equal throughout the state? What are you seeing out there?
We really haven't done an analysis of the geographic distribution of these newly impaired waters. We have them throughout the state. We're finding these new listings throughout the state.
So give us some examples of some of the major waterways that made the list on your recommendation this year.
Some of them, trying to think if there are major, I can't think of any major waterways that were added off the top of my head, but we do have, if you tune into our website, if you go to our DNR's main homepage and you type in the word impaired waters in the search tool, what you can get is we have a search tool available where you can actually type in the name of a water body and determine if it's listed on our impaired waters list. So we do have these search options available on our website, people can look at the larger list of impaired waters and see if any water body nearby is included on that list.
Help us understand what this means for us in our everyday life. To what extent does a polluted waterway affect, for example, the water that we drink?
Well, next steps in terms of impaired waters, again, these are for surface waters. This list applies to streams and lakes, the surface water of the state. What the next step is in terms of management actions is essentially to come up with a restoration plan. So for each impaired water, we work with local partners to develop a restoration plan to identify what the sources are of the pollution, and then to develop a way to achieve the needed reductions for that water body to meet water quality standards.
You highlight that impaired waters every 2 years, that you're measuring this as part of the Federal Clean Water Act, and the law requires states to prioritize problem bodies of water and establish plans to get them into compliance. What does that usually entail, and who's responsible for making that happen?
The plans are typically, there are partnerships, as I mentioned, with local groups, but DNR is the agency responsible for developing these plans. They're referred to as total maximum daily loads. TMDL is the acronym. Essentially, those plans are what sets the allocations to each source in a drainage area, an area that drains to an impaired water body. We set up a list of all the sources and then assign those allocations to what's needed to meet the water quality standards. So, yeah, again, DNR works with partners to develop those, but we have the responsibility to develop those and then to submit those to EPA for approval.
The DNR has said that 75% of the water that that they monitor, that you monitor, is showing signs of long-term improvement. What accounts for that?
We have a number of programs that are in place that have helped to achieve water quality standards across the state. The 75% of the water bodies are those that we've looked at in this last couple of years and found that roughly 75% do meet water quality standards, which is a great success, I think, to have that level of water quality in the state. We have a number of programs, working with producers, farmers, municipalities to address non-point sources of pollution. That's, like I mentioned earlier, sources like runoff when it rains. We have programs in place to address those sources, as well as to point sources, like discharging, wastewater into streams and lakes. So those are permitted through our permitting program. And so we have, a combination of programs that are available, as well as funding opportunities, too, for people to receive funding to help implement some of these management practices.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sure. That was Aaron Larson, Water Resources Management Specialist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, talking about a new report on water pollution in the state.
There are certain phrases and sayings that have made their way into our everyday speech that can seem harmless, but can cause a serious breakdown in our personal communications.
We're talking about phrases like, I want you to know, or I'm just saying. Here to explain how these seemingly innocent turns of phrase can mean something more sinister is Elizabeth Bernstein. She wrote about this in her column, Why Verbal Tee-Ups Like To Be Honest Often Signal Insincerity. She writes a relationships column called Bonds for the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
What phrases are you talking about when you say verbal tee-ups?
I'm talking about these phrases that seem really polite, and I think maybe on the surface we may think we're doing them for a polite reason, but subconsciously we aren't. They're saying something else if you read between the lines. So these are phrases, the one I hate the most is, don't take this the wrong way. I just can't stand that one. Or, I'm just saying, as you said, or to be honest, those kinds of sayings.
And how do they change the meaning of what's coming next? Or can you even pay attention to what's coming next after that preamble?
You can't. What they do is they're signaling to the listener, whoa, you better be careful here, because something that's coming next is something I'm uncomfortable telling you. That's really what I take away, and the researchers say they will really take away from this. So, for example, to be honest. Well, why do you have to signal your honesty? If you're really being honest, why do you have to, you know, say it? It makes the listener tense up and think, wow, like, if this person's being honest now, are they always being honest other times?
Well, how can they break down how can they cause a breakdown in communication? And they seem so harmless.
They seem harmless. They seem very polite. And also, it's interesting, since I wrote the article, a lot of people wrote me from all over the country saying, oh, we have regional ones. I heard all over the South people wrote me about, bless your heart. And I said, well, give me an example of that. And they said, well, bless your heart, you've gained a little weight. So it's something that, you know, you think it's like, I don't hate me or slug me for what I'm about to tell you. It's really. And then in Boston, they wrote and they said, oh, we're big on this one. Not for nothing, but. I never heard that one. Not for nothing, but gained a little weight.
Wow, the bless your heart one is new to me.
Yeah. Right? It's not. I'm a Midwesterner, and that one was new to me, too.
Well, and this, it's always signaling, I'm going to tell you bad news. I'm maybe trying to signal that I don't want to be. In fact, there's the one, I hate to be the one to tell you this.
Yeah, I hate
in
to be
fact,
the one to
it's
you.
Probably the opposite. I'm quite pleased to be the one to tell you this. In a lot of the cases, is what really happens, isn't it?
Exactly. They can't wait to tell you whatever it is. Let's just stick on the weight. You gained a little weight, but I'm only telling you this because I love you. That one is pretty much almost the worst one because you really love the person. You might think of their feelings first, and the harm that whatever you're going to tell them is going to do.
But thinking about it from the speaker's perspective, I suppose, don't these tee-ups make it easier to be honest? You know, you don't want to be the one to say it, but someone's got to say it, and it makes it easier for me to say it when I soften the blow a little bit with a little bit of a preamble.
Well, that's just it. We think we're softening the blow. The speaker does think, I'm softening the blow. I feel like I need to say this. I'm going to soften the blow. But it's not really softening the blow because we all know, and these have been around forever. We actually got a letter from Ralph Nader, said, look, you know, my mom wrote about these 30 years ago. So she wrote a column about them. So, you know, I'm not saying anything new. I'm just saying it again for our generations now. But these are things that the listeners know. It's not going to go well. And I started my column by saying, you know, I had a friend who said to me, yeah, I was all dressed up. We're at a party. I'm all excited. I'm happy to be there with my friends. He says, listen, don't take this the wrong way. And I couldn't hear anything else. I just knew whatever it was going to be so awful. And whatever it was wasn't that great. But you know what? It would have been a lot better if he just said, hey, there's something I need to tell you, or just blurted it out.
Are we bad people when we say these things? Are we really thinking we're being nicer? Are we taking a moment to relish in saying something bad? Or what does it say about us when we say these things?
It says we're not really thinking. So some people may use this. You know, I don't take this again. Don't take this the wrong way means don't be mad at me. And the reason it's so nasty is because it's saying it's taking away the listener's right to have an actual feeling or reaction about what's being told to them. So not only am I going to tell you something bad, but you don't even have a right to be upset with me about it. So that's from the listener. From what you asked about, you know, from the speaker, we're not thinking. Some people are. They think, okay, if I say bless her heart and I bring, you know, I invoke God into this, then I've got a free pass. I can say anything. That's not true. And so we need to think about what we're saying. Think about our speech. We should be careful with it. Words, you know, words are mean a lot. And we're just not thinking when we do it.
Why did one expert that you spoke to equate politeness with deception?
Well, he's somebody at University of Texas. He studies language and lies. He studies lies as well. And he says, you know, when we're being really polite, yes, there's a need for it. It's sort of social grease. We do need to be polite. You know, you can't really say, you know, to your spouse, no, honey, I hate your haircut, you know, or you're losing a little hair. You can't really always say everything what you want to do. So politeness has a function. But if you think about it, much of politeness is fakeness. We might really be thinking, gosh, like that haircut is not working. So it's necessary in some ways, and it's very helpful for society to get along, for civilization. But it's not the truth either.
Okay. Sometimes, though, we honestly do want to communicate something unpleasant to a person. How do we break ourselves of the, to be honest, or I hate to be the one to tell you this, those preambles, and just come out and say it? How do we fix this?
Well, I think if you think about, you know, the fact, okay, I have to say something really difficult to somebody I care about, you know, you can't, I don't get off the hook for doing that. I have to do it, so I have to sort of take the lump with it. So I need to say to them, just as you said it really, hey, do you have time to talk? There's something I really want to tell you, but it's hard for me, or something like that. Be honest. Don't say, you know, don't take this the wrong way. Or,
wait, is that any less scary? I really need to have a serious talk with you, man. I mean, that doesn't sound any less threatening than I hate to tell
talk.
You this.
I said, do you have time to talk? Yeah. that'll get their attention. And in fact, what's so funny is marital counselors say all the time that spouses, especially wives, should say this to their husbands. Do you have time to talk? When they want to talk about something important or something that might be emotional, because men are, one, they're focused on one thing, it tends to be at the time, like research could back me up on this, and they don't like to be hit up when they're, you know, busy doing whatever it is, work, watching the game, fixing the car, whatever it is they're doing. They don't want to be slammed with a big relationship. Talk. So, you know, do you have time to talk is almost always a good thing to say.
Another thing, if we see ourselves saying those things, you know, I want to be honest with you or whatever too often, does that mean we're just saying bad stuff to people too often and we need to triage what we fill them in on?
Exactly. If you're running around saying that, you may, you know, have this false notion that, you know, because I'm giving these tee ups, the, you know, preamble to it, I think I'm giving this information gently, but maybe I should think about the actual information that's coming after these phrases. Like, does it really need to be said, or could it be said in a different way? In the instance of my friend who said, don't take this the wrong way, it was something that probably needed to be said, but it should have been a conversation, not a one sentence here. I got something bad to tell you. Now I don't want to hear anything you have to say. That's what it's saying. I don't want to hear your reaction. Just going to throw this at you. So we should be thinking about what it is we're really saying, you know, after these little phrases.
Elizabeth, you've studied, you know, relationships. You've written about it for a while, and I'm sure you've talked to many experts about this as well. I'm wondering if you have heard of this happening more maybe in the Midwest, where people are stereotypically more polite,
nice.
Yeah, nice, quote unquote, and might be more prone to using verbal tee-ups like this versus, say, the East Coast.
You know, I don't, it's interesting. I didn't see any research on that, but my gut would say yes. You know, in the areas where they, you know, do put a very big, you know, premium on being polite, it's, and they're less abrupt, they're more sort of, quieter. Really. So, you know, say Wisconsin, Minnesota, these are quieter cultures really than maybe New York or LA. So, yeah, I think that they might. I really got a sense through doing some other radio shows that were national, that in the South, this is huge. Like that it also is a culture that's very, very much, the Southerners calling in were telling me, you know, this, we're very polite, but it's almost a fake politeness. We're raised to say things, other than what we're thinking.
Elizabeth, bless your heart, but I think it's got to be hard to be you. You write about this stuff, and now are you constantly watching yourself and catching yourself about
it's
to say these
terrible.
Things?
Terrible. And my family just calls me on it left and right. It's just awful. My friends, did you just do what you said not to do? Yes, it's tough to be me. And Ralph Nader is calling to scold me or emailing to scold me. So it's tough.
Is social media changing the way that we use tee-ups? Real quickly in our last minute here.
It is. I think it is because we are, look, we're saying all these things. We're so used to, look at Facebook, it's 10 years today, their birthday, but also we say everything on there and we get in these fights, especially around the time of the elections. You know, we get in these fights about stuff. And so we, again, start to think, oh, well, if I just preface it with, you know, to be honest, you're an idiot. I think I said it better.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Bernstein is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. You can find her on Twitter at eBernsteinWSJ. She was with us to talk about her column, Why Verbal Tee-Ups, Like to Be Honest, Often Signal Insincerity, and she writes the Bonds column for The Wall Street Journal.
Microsoft founder and philanthropist Bill Gates recently published his annual letter on world issues. And this year, the topic is three myths that block progress for the poor. Things like poor countries will always be poor, or foreign aid is a big waste.
Gargi Ghosh joins us now. She's Director of Development Policy and Finance at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Gargi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The first myth of the Bill Gates list is the idea that poor countries are doomed to be poor forever. Is that a common belief that you hear a lot?
It is, and I think it's really prevalent in just dinner conversation. We've seen poverty around for a long time. Maybe it'll exist as long as we're around. And Bill makes a really exciting prediction in the paper, and that is that by 2035, he thinks that there will be very few poor countries left in the world. And the rest of the letter is really about how we can help make that happen.
Well, why is it a common belief in the first place that poor countries are doomed to be poor forever? And why isn't that true?
Well, I think it's easy to believe that progress should be faster than you see it or feel it. We've been talking about poverty around the world in many of the regions that we're familiar with for years, for most of our lifetime. But if you dig a little deeper, there are great stories of success. One of the countries that we talk about a lot is South Korea, which had been a recipient of major aid 40, 50 years ago. And today, they've actually become a really exciting and important donor. They give money to poor countries around the world. That same story of growth and changing roles and really different experiences for households, for families, is true in Brazil, in Costa Rica, even in India.
Well, let's take maybe South Korea as an example. How long did it take to see that growth and move the country out of poverty?
That's a really great question. I think the South Korean story is one that you typically talk about as a sort of 60-year development path. But that's not to say that that's a prediction for other countries. Botswana, for example, in southern Africa, had a much quicker trajectory. They've got diamonds and other natural resources that they've managed really well and have used that to invest in education, in healthcare, in job creation, and they've had a much faster story.
Well, the next thing on Bill Gates' list was that foreign aid spending is a waste. Why do people buy into that myth?
Well, I'll be curious what your listeners say. I think it's, first of all, been really amazing for me to learn how much people think we do spend on foreign aid. There's a statistic in the letter that says some polling thought that most people think we spend about 25% of our budget on foreign aid, and that they'd be happy, they'd feel better about it if we just spent 10%. The reality is we spend less than 1% of our budget on aid, so I suppose we'd be happy to split the difference. But for that amount of money, in the past 10 years, we've vaccinated 500 million children. We are close to eradicating polio. We've increased education rates in sub-Saharan Africa from sort of under 50% to well over 70%. So the return on investment in foreign aid is really terrific.
Don't we see cases where foreign money is wasted, misused, or even siphoned off by corrupt governments, though?
Of course, yeah. And the letter talks about two kinds of corruption, and I think it's a helpful distinction. One, that sort of small-scale corruption, government official takes a bribe to get your driver's license through FASTA or something. And Bill talks about this as a sort of tax on foreign aid. Of course, we should root it out, but is that a reason to stop saving lives? The other kind is the much bigger, more systemic kind of corruption that you're talking about. And there, I think we've made some important progress on what is a critical issue to get right. It used to be that aid was Had the feeling of sort of writing a check and walking away. And today I see a lot more partnership where the people who are giving money are working alongside the people who are receiving money, that both are funding, and they're working together to implement projects, to provide oversight. Technology has been really helpful in that front because now you have a lot of internet-based or mobile phone-based capabilities where people can write in and say, you know, my street was supposed to be fixed and it's not fixed yet. And people are actually using this kind of technology, and it's a great way to ramp up visibility and transparency in the way money is getting spent. So I think we've made a lot of progress in the right direction. Of course, there's more to be done, but we are moving in the right direction.
How can we make sure that we get the best effect from foreign aid money?
Well, let me give you an example of what I think is a great success story. So smallpox, ancient disease, been around since, you know, 10,000 BC. My uncle in India had one of the last cases of smallpox in the early 70s. When I went there for the first time with my family, I had to get a smallpox vaccine. And by 1980, the world was smallpox-free. We have eradicated that disease. And that was a partnership between funders, the rich world, and the poor world, who together invested in developing the vaccine, in organizing the campaign, delivering the product, doing the monitoring and evaluation to make sure the world was smallpox-free. That's the kind of just life-changing success that I think you can achieve with the right mission, the focus, the products, the partnerships.
There's also a more isolationist view that problems in other parts of the world are not relevant necessarily to more fortunate countries. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I can understand why that's the case. We've got problems here that we are dealing with. I have two ways that I like to think about it. One is it's something that we talk about a lot at the Foundation, and that's all lives have equal value. I'm a mom, and I hate the thought of other kids around the world not having a fair chance at life or even just basic health and education. With the policy brain side of me, I also think that a lot of the problems we're trying to deal with have spillover effects. Global health is a great example of that, where isolationism doesn't apply because diseases, infections cross borders. We've seen that with outbreaks of polio. We see that with cholera when there's a natural disaster. And so there really is no such thing as just closing your borders.
Let's move to the third thing on Bill Gates' list. He says that one myth is that the idea that saving lives with foreign aid leads to overpopulation, so it just makes more problems down the road. Why is that a myth?
Well, I think it's a totally rational one to think that if less kids die, over time the population will just grow at unsustainable levels. Actually, the evidence is pretty counterintuitive, because what you see happening is that as fewer kids die, as child mortality declines, parents are able to plan better and have fewer kids. So you see this correlation between improved child survival and declining birth rates, because people don't have to have more kids to make sure that just a couple survive. And so they start planning better and making rational choices based on improved chances of survival.
We're talking about global poverty and common myths about relief efforts with Gargi Ghosh of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
And we want to hear what you think. Do you think, say, the U.S. government should do more or less when it comes to fighting poverty around the globe? Do you think foreign aid money is money well spent or money wasted? Do you personally make donations or volunteer or work for anti-global poverty efforts? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@wpr.org.
We continue our conversation about global poverty with Gargi Ghosh of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
And you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think that countries like the United States have an obligation to put money into foreign aid to fighting poverty and disease around the world? Or do you think that's money wasted? Would you rather not see that being a priority? Do you make donations to groups that fight international poverty and related issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Gargi, to what extent do these myths about foreign relief keep governments and individuals from providing anti-poverty aid?
You know, I think it really makes it harder for governments to keep giving, especially in tough economic times. And we've found that governments are incredibly responsive, as they should be, to the values and priorities of their citizens. And so the more we can do to have people express their interest in the value they place on giving good foreign aid, the better it is, the easier it is for governments. People as individuals actually are quite generous. And we've seen that after lots of disasters in Haiti, typhoons in South Asia, people give tremendously because they believe they can make a difference. And translating that to the difference governments can make through foreign aid is an extension of that.
And, well, when you mention natural disasters and specific events that incite and inspire some generosity, I also draw a contrast in my mind to countries around the world that have sustained poverty all the time, not necessarily tethered to special circumstances. What more could perhaps governments or nonprofit groups do to draw that distinction and maybe inspire people to help anti-poverty efforts, regardless of whether there's a special circumstance tied to it?
One of the things that we've been really excited about is telling stories about success. I think people are pretty naturally motivated by believing that their contribution can make a difference, whatever that is, if it's volunteering or resources or just writing a letter to your government, to your congressman to encourage the continuation of foreign aid. You want to believe that makes a difference, and it does. And so we've been trying to pull out success stories where either families have had been able to put their kids into school, or moms have been able to get access to jobs and food or an education themselves, and feature those more prominently than the kind of great stories of disasters and poverty that that tend to get much more airtime. And hopefully that's motivating, and that gives people sort of specific examples of how we all can help.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our conversation about global poverty and anti-poverty efforts around the world. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Mary in Duluth.
Hi. I just tuned in a couple minutes ago, so I don't know if this has already been addressed, but I heard the question, and I was just thinking that our country could do so much good in the world for our own citizens and for the poor in other parts of the world. We could do a lot more good if we weren't, as I understand it, in our federal budget, in the discretionary spending, 57%, 57 cents of every dollar goes to the Pentagon, goes to fund war and, militarism rather than peace, rather than the planet, rather than, all the good things that we could be doing. Of course, we need some defense, but I think 57%, 57 cents on the dollar is way, way overboard. And it just, that really concerns me. We need to, to shift our priorities, I think. So anyway, thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Gargi Ghosh, what is your response to that? First of all, is that statistic, does that hold true, 57 cents per dollar going to the Pentagon? And what's your response about the call to change priorities in Washington?
I hadn't heard that statistic, and am shocked by it, just as your caller was. I certainly agree with the idea that if we're getting the kind of results we do on vaccination, on education, with less than 1%, there sure is a lot more we could do.
And does that send a message around the world about American priorities? Does it affect our relationships with foreign governments in that way?
I think it's absolutely true that when we are kind of partners in a country's development, it just totally changes the kind of discussion that we're able to have with the country. I don't work for the U.S. government, so I can't give you a specific example, but I've certainly noticed that even with the foundation's presence there in countries where we work, like Ethiopia or Nigeria, it's all part of a conversation or a representation of the United States in a country, and these recipient countries are really excited to be partners in development with us.
Ron in Milwaukee joins us now. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I think it's really great that you're helping, and you know, you mentioned the disease and the you know, the education part of it. But what are you doing to help these people get out of poverty as far as building wealth and creating jobs and creating the sustainability, you know, so that they can be self-sufficient?
Gargi?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you look at development assistance, so the full picture of what the U.S. government provides or the U.S. development assistance provides, that includes a lot of what the caller is asking about. So a lot of skills training, support to provide loans to small businesses. At the foundation, we just have to make some choices. And so what our co-chairs focus us on are really the kind of basic building blocks that allow people to participate in an economy. So if you think about your basic health and vaccination, how is that relevant to the bigger stuff? Well, you know, if you vaccinate kids, if you get them a sort of basic calorie intake food, that provides them the cognitive ability to learn. And then you work on providing them education, and that allows them to get a job and participate in the economy. So it's a multi-step process, but it's all part of the chain that's got to come together.
And I think what Ron was getting at well is the availability of jobs. What circumstances are some around the world facing in that way? They may have the cognitive ability and the education to get a job. What if there aren't any jobs around?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point here, as well as elsewhere, of course, right? So that's where the partnership with governments really matters, because that's not something that you know, outside money can just drop in. That's where you need government policy to encourage the creation of business, to create sort of platforms for industry to grow. And I think that's becoming a greater and greater priority for governments who are finally getting some of the basic stuff right.
Let's talk to Cade in La Crosse. Hi, Cade.
Hi. I'm calling and wondering, you look at how people go about fixing situations, they typically will go about it in a linear fashion, fixing one thing at a time. And we're always talking about fixing the world as a whole or fixing problems that have already happened. Why hasn't the conversation ever come up of fixing the most positive countries or countries that have the brightest future, and then working then going putting all our money towards that and then moving on to, like, every year?
What about that concentrated and more focused efforts one at a time?
Actually, I think we're starting to do a bit of that. If you think about development assistance 50 years ago, it was a really blunt instrument. There were rich countries and there were poor countries, and rich countries wrote checks to poor countries. And today the world is a much more sort of nuanced place. And so if you take a country like India, where they've gone from being a really poor, low-income country to now what's classified as a sort of low, middle-income country, they're doing better, but they're not yet rich, and they have lots of poor people still. The way you engage in a country like that is really different from a very poor country, a Malawi or a Mali. And we're starting to get better at understanding how you work with a government in Ethiopia to target help to the pockets of poverty to the people who haven't been able to sort of take advantage of the increase in average wealth. And that's and sort of getting those countries over the finish line to sort of a sustainable spot is absolutely critical. I totally agree. But I think you can do that alongside trying to get the sort of building blocks right in some of the very poor countries.
As people think about issues of poverty around the world and perhaps consider making donations to help with the effort against poverty, what's the most effective way for them to help? How do they know that their money is going to the right place?
Well, I think one of the most effective things you can do is write to your member of Congress to tell them what you believe in and why they should support the cause for foreign assistance in whatever form you believe, if it's vaccination or education or infrastructure. And then I think for people who are giving their own money or their own time, there are lots of really good sort of charity trackers, navigators that will give you reports on which organizations do what with their money. And those are really important to sort of navigate what can potentially be a complicated or crowded space. And they're great organizations to be part of.
Where are some of the top priorities in 2014 for global anti-poverty programs?
That's a great question. So one of the big things coming up on the horizon for us is in 2015, actually, it's the end of a period that something called the Millennium Development Goals. This is where the world got together and agreed a sort of basic set of commitments around access to health and education and clean drinking water and the elimination of poverty. And 2015 is the deadline that we set for ourselves. And we've made incredible progress in that time. During that time, poverty in the world halved. Extreme poverty. This is sort of people living on $1 or $2 a day. There are dramatically millions fewer. And so we're just moving into the period where we're setting the next set of goals and looking to sort of eliminate poverty or get well past where we are today, get to the next level of sort of bringing a minimal standard of health and education even further into populations. So that's a really exciting time to just take stock of how much progress we've made, the work that we didn't get done, and set another set of goals for ourselves.
Gargi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
That was Gargi Ghosh with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bill Gates recently released his annual letter. This year's, it's headlined, Three Myths That Block Progress for the Poor.